Hello and welcome once again to our program. This is Christian Answers, and I'm Larry Wessels, Director of Christian Answers, and I want to thank you for being with us today for today's broadcast. I'm here with our Director of Research, Steve Morrison. Steve, always great to have you with me, brother.
Thank you, Larry.
And today we're going to cover the subject of Islam. This is show number 2 in a series we're doing on Islam entitled The Sects. That's S-E-C-T-S, The Sects of Islam. And in this particular show, we're going to cover the Sunni Muslims, one of the groups of, or these sects or groups of Islam that you as a Christian or whoever else happens to be watching us right now will sooner or later run into. I was tempted to say that bad joke, Sunni or later run into, but I resisted that.
Okay.
But anyway,
resisted.
Yeah. I'd like to mention at this point that we do come from a Christian perspective, and we do love our Muslim friends and neighbors. We are just as eager to reach them with what we believe to be the truth of God as they would be to reach us with what they perceive to be the truth. And in any religious dialogue, the only way to arrive at the truth is to analyze what is considered to be or purported to be truth and see if that is really the case. And so in this series of programs, we're going to analyze the Sunni sect of Islam and see what it has to offer as far as the truth claims that it might purport through the Islamic faith. Well, Steve, as we get into this, I just want to mention for other viewers that we do put through Christian Answers out newsletters. We have tracts such as these that you put together, the Bukhari Hadith of Islam, Parts 1 and 2. We have other free resources that are available for anyone that wants to call or write our program for more information. We've also done other videos on Islam and other subjects for those that are interested. So, Steve, with this subject now introduced, the Sunni Muslims, what would you like to introduce us with as far as this subject goes?
Well, first of all, many non-Muslims are probably unaware that most Muslims don't only follow the Quran, but they have this massive collection of traditions, which are called hadiths that they follow.
Oh, just what I mentioned in our little tracks.
That's one of the main ones.
The Bukhari hadiths.
That's
okay.
Held the highest, actually.
Okay.
And but even if you're a Sunni Muslim watching this, hopefully you'll find some things you may learn about Sunni Islam, some details maybe you didn't know before. To establish the importance of the hadith in Sunni Islam, let me read from the Sahih Muslim, which is probably the second highest authority
behind,
on
the hadith. That's behind the al-Bukhari hadith.
Right. Okay. This is on volume 4, page 256. This is actually in a footnote of the translation, not in the hadith itself. But it talks about the hadith. It says, "These ordinances constitute what is described as the sunnah of the Holy Prophet, may peace be upon him, and it has full legal force side by side with the Quran." Okay, so if it has full legal force, then people live and die, basically based on what these hadiths say. Okay, and divisions among Muslims can be very serious. For example, not only have Muslims like burned down churches in Indonesia and Sudan and other places, but actually mosques have been burned down in Sudan by other Muslims of different sects. So, you're not even safe from Muslim terrorists if you're a Muslim, to be honest. Also, there were many early battles between the different Muslims, such as Muawiyah I and Ali's supporters, and then Yazid versus the Shiites, and starting with the Battle of Siffin, which was in July of 657 A.D. Okay, so for authorities on the Quran, how do you interpret that? The Sunnis claim that the sources of authority are the Quran, the Hadith. Then they typically say it's the logic of analogy. So if Hadith mention one thing, then you can generalize it to things that maybe didn't exist back then. And then finally, the community of Muslims. And we're going to talk about each of the authoritative Hadiths. These Hadiths, they were collected only and sifted through only about 2 centuries after Muhammad's death. So it was kind of a period of time for things to settle, and they had to try to take out what might have been added spuriously. As we said, the most important collection of Hadiths is the Bukhari Hadith, which there's an English translation that says half English on one side and Arabic on the other side, but al-Bukhari, and that's in back right here, in Arabic and in English, and is actually published in Pakistan. Now, Muhammad died, we think, around 632, 633 A.D., and Bukhari, he lived from 810 to 870 A.D., and he made a collection of 7,275 hadiths that he felt were authentic out of maybe around 300,000 hadiths. Okay, and it is recognized as next only to the Quran in authority. Okay, Bukhari actually was just, that was his nickname. He was named after the town of Bukhara in Central Asia. And in the hadith, what he does is he gives the claimed ultimate source of the hadith, like Abu Huraira, you know, the freed slave said, or Aisha, Muhammad's apostle said, or Abu Bakr said. So you can see what's the source of it. And occasionally, but not too often, he gives maybe multiple hadiths with almost the same wording, just a little different with just different people. Okay. And curious about Bukhari is, in Bukhari hadith, there are a large number of miracles performed by Muhammad. Now that's interesting because the Quran says Muhammad did no other miracles except for the Quran itself. Mm-hmm. So there's something kind of strange there. Some of the miracles are like bringing water out of a rock, causing the moon to be split in two, many things that were basically fighting and tying up or subduing rather a jinn or genie.
I heard something like sometimes the food would cry out with praise to Allah that was on Muhammad's table coming from the al-Bukhari hadith. But that's just another kind of a miracle thing that I'd heard. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that the Quran itself says the only miracle that Muhammad did was the Quran.
Right, right.
And
So Shiites or non-Sunnis might see something a little fishy here.
Yeah, because these things you're describing are supernatural. They would have to be considered a miracle.
Yeah, and we don't deny that God can do miracles. We do deny that Muhammad is a prophet of God. But some of these miracles, it's like, well, if no one else saw them, no other culture saw it, like the splitting of the moon, that's kind of, it's like, well, you think somebody might have noticed that.
So to me, that almost looks like a contradiction between the hadith with these miracles and the Quran, which says the only miracle is the Quran.
Right. Right.
So anyway.
And anyway, the next highest in authority is called Sahih Muslim, named after Imam Muslim, and he lived from 817 to 875 A.D., and he had 7,190 hadiths. Now, actually, he had a little different approach. He put the original source of the hadith, like Bukhari did, but he also put lots of hadiths together that were almost the same, just a little bit different, or one a little longer than the other, or differences in wording, so you kind of compare. So he may have, let's say, 10 hadiths that all say essentially the same things, just a few little differences from different sources. So the number of independent sayings is about 4,000. Okay? And so overall, he has less material than Bukhari. And the statement was made, I've seen that, well, everything that's in the other hadiths is pretty much in Bukhari because it's the biggest. Well, that's a lot of stuff is in it, but that's not totally true. For example, Sahih Muslim says there's a surah of the Quran that was lost, and it gives a small excerpt from that, which is kind of interesting. And it also talks about many miracles that Muhammad did.
Now, I know in some of the hadiths, it mentions how some of the companions of Muhammad were alarmed that, for instance, Muhammad had a law about adultery, and yet it wasn't put in the Quran, but it was mentioned as an important rule by Muhammad in the hadith.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost looked upon by some of these companions of Muhammad that, well, man, this is kind of an important law from Allah about adultery, but yet it didn't make it into the Quran, but it's in the hadith. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of ties into what you were just reading.
Okay. Yeah. The one that's usually acknowledged as maybe the third most important is by Abu Dawud al-Sijistani. And he lived from 817 to either 888 or 889 A.D., and he has about 4,800 hadiths out of what he said were about 500,000. Now, he had a little different principle. He had the principle that the transmitters are considered trustworthy provided there is no formal proof to discredit them. So if there's somebody who is a transmitter and they have a name and you have no idea who they are, you have no proof against them, well, then it's considered trustworthy. Okay, so Omega is not held in quite as high authority as Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Okay, the fourth one is Abu Isa Muhammad Ibn Isa, Isa is, by the way, Arabic for Jesus, bin Sara at-Tirmidhi. And Tirmidhi is also named after the village of Tirmid. He was from 825 to 892 AD, and he had about 3,956 hadiths. Now, he was a pupil of Bukhari, so he wasn't like totally independent collection, but he did have his own work. And also, just to let you know, there's a famous Sufi mystic of a similar time period called Tirmidhi, but they are unrelated people. Okay. The other two, kind of like the most maybe influential six hadiths, was Nasai, which was 830 to 915 AD, which was a little later than the others. And another one is Ibn Majah, which is 824 to 866 AD. But these are not as authoritative. There are a couple other collections of traditions that were done at a later time, based primarily upon these initial collections. One is the Riyad Us-Salihin, and it has 2,000 selected hadiths. Not saying that there are only 2,000 authoritative, but 2,000 that may be most relevant. Mm-hmm. And it was collected by Imam Abu Zakariya, Yahya bin Sharaf an-Nawawi, and he was from 1233 to either 1277, 1279 AD. And he also wrote a commentary in Bukhari, and he studied Sahih Muslim. And the Encyclopedia Britannica says an interesting thing about him. It said that some traditions were abrogated by the fiction of a higher tradition that was never written down.
So that's interesting. Some traditions were abrogated by the fiction of a higher tradition that was never written down.
So in other words, if you have tradition A in the hadith and you have tradition B, you say that tradition B supersedes tradition A. The trouble is there's no written record of this tradition.
It's just like a verbal tradition. Is that what you're saying?
Alleged verbal tradition, yes.
Maybe a legend that's just been passed down somewhere.
Right, or made up, yeah.
And it suddenly knocks out or abrogates. That's what basically abrogation means. Something abrogated is taken away or taken out. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So something not written down could actually supersede something that is written down based on what you're just saying here.
Right. And if you look at the chart we have up, Fiqh Sunnah is a more modern one that's being done. It's kind of more systemized. And it will be 12 volumes when it's done, but currently I think there are only 5 done, or I only have 5 volumes. But if you look at these, what I did is that the leftmost number is the number of pages in each hadith that discuss each of these 16 topics. And the rightmost number is the number of hadiths. Now, some of these hadiths are short and long, so there's not necessarily a correlation between the two. But just looking on the bottom, if you take these 16 topics, then you have, in Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, you've basically covered about 80 to 85% of everything that they're talking about.
Well, just with these 16 topics.
Just those 16 topics.
So you've got, in these topics, most of everything that's really important.
Right.
According to the hadith.
Yeah.
This is what's really important.
Right.
According to the hadith.
Now, if you're wondering what I left out, some of the minor things are like sealing yourself in the mosque and Sahih Muslim, or like there's a fair amount in government that I didn't put in here, but just the things I have here is 80 to 85%.
So this is what Muslims really should be concerned with.
You would kind of tend to imply that, at least that they were concerned. And so if you look, for example, they have just general teaching on the Quran, and that's a pretty big category, third from the bottom, because it has stuff from like end times to law and creation to the Quran itself to how to teach the Quran to doctrine. So that's a pretty big category, as you'd expect. But then, you know, about roughly 6% of everything in there is about business and money. Okay, about almost 5% is on marriage and divorce. Now, we can agree with them. Those are fairly important topics, and we talk about that. Prayer and prayer mechanics is more about how to pray, when to pray, when you're forbidden to pray, 11%. Now, war and jihad, which, you know, people would like to say, well, jihad is not jihad of the sword, and there's no fighting in Islam, I guess. Well, 11% of all hadiths talk about jihad.
jihad, war, and you've got the word here, booty.
Yeah, collecting booty, the spoils of war, and they differentiate between what you captured after battle, or when you've been approaching a non-Muslim town and the people all fled, than what you just collected that was abandoned.
So would it cover something like, when we're talking about war and jihad, would these hadiths cover something like, with the aspect of, okay, see, I have a town out here, I'm going to attack it. I captured a town. Let's say I capture several men and children and a bunch of women. Does that, aspect, can I take the women as slaves? Can I kill the men? Can I take the children into bondage? How does that work?
It says you can take the women, you can have sex with the women captives, even though you're not married with them.
What if the captive woman, after a jihad, and you capture is... let's say you capture her and her husband, but you really would like to have that woman.
Okay. Can you
still do anything even though she's married?
All right. What I've read is that, let's say the husband has fled but is still alive. Then they said that the marriage, there was no divorce, but they said you can still have sex with her or even marry her because the marriage was abrogated by your capturing her.
Okay. So in the hadith, then, if I capture a woman who's married to someone else, I can still take her for my own self,
right?
Because by virtue of what the hadith say, her marriage to whoever else she's married to is abrogated.
Right.
Now she's mine.
Right. Okay. Now Muslims today, by the way, they talk about jihad as there's an internal jihad, like the internal struggle for righteousness, or they talk about jihad of the pen, about spreading Islam, versus jihad of the sword. But if you look in the hadith, the only jihad they're talking about is the jihad of the sword, or the jihad of taxation, taxing the non-Muslims, or of how to control or persecute or evict non-Muslims.
So it's not talking in these hadiths here, these authentic hadiths, about I'm going to morally persuade people with my articulate, eloquent speaking to get them to...
The only thing it says about that is that if there's let's say there's a non-Muslim town somewhere, mm-hmm. it would talk about first... giving them the opportunity, talking to them to accept Islam. And then if they don't accept, then you have the right to do a preemptive, but an offensive attack on them, even an unsuspecting attack on them.
Sneak up on them unawares.
Right. At dawn while they're herding cattle and whatever.
And destroy them with the sword.
Capture them and then give them an
opportunity.
Enslave
them.
Yeah. And fight against them, and of course, kill them in battle, and then of course, if they convert to Islam, then they're treated generously.
Okay, so but basically, the jihads here though are more of a physical, violent nature, not so much like the jihad of the pen, as you just mentioned,
right.
Where I'm going to write and try to persuade them with good arguments
and we'll get into this when we do the show on understanding Muslim hearts. But basically, in one of the hadiths, they have the word jihad, and then in the English translation, in parentheses, they put military expeditions.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so just in case you weren't sure of the meaning.
Well, I wanted to kind of center on that because that's on a lot of people's minds these days,
right.
About the jihad, and so I figured I'd spend a little extra time on it. But anyway, they get into the funerals and all these different things, but this is 85% or most of the stuff that's the washing rituals.
Right.
Washing is very important in Islam. We can get into that later.
What's just interesting thing is that notice that they have almost twice as much on war and jihad as they do on marriage. And they have almost twice as much as they do on war as they do on business. And they have more, and you think of the five main pillars of Orthodox Islam, jihad is like a sixth pillar according to the Karajites, but it's only five for most Muslims. They only have about 2% on taxes and alms and 5% on pilgrimages, but they have 11% on war and jihad and booty.
So 11%, it's almost like 10% of everything that Islam stands for is based on jihad.
Yeah, and by the way, the way I got these numbers is by reading through Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. I just calculated the page numbers. So these numbers, I'll say, are based upon these two hadiths. Fiqh as-Sunnah and Tirmidhi and Dawood are not.
And what you're just sort of, we've mentioned this in our other Islamic video series that we've done, but just for the sake of the viewers, you have read these hadiths yourself personally. Mm-hmm. You've read through them cover to cover, You've read the Quran cover to cover.
Twice, yeah.
Right. And so this isn't like you're just picking up this information from someone else. You yourself personally have done this research.
Right, right. And it's important to read to like see the context. And the hadiths are like often disjointed, let's say, paragraphs. I mean, sometimes it could be a couple pages, sometimes a few sentences. So reading it, you know, you have all the context that the author of the hadith, you know, wanted you to have, looking at that. And also when you see the different hadiths and you see different flavors of kind of similar things, you can kind of have some context there. But anyway, you know, it's like if someone wants to tell me that, oh, it's out of context, it's like, well, have you read it all yourself first? You know. So anyway, talking about hadiths, to say that Sunnis believe the hadiths are important is actually an understatement. What one footnote in Sahih Muslim, Volume 1, page 72, says, this part of the hadith is clearly indicative of the fact that the hadith is the indispensable key to the correct understanding of the Quran, because as the bearer of revelation, the Holy Prophet was best fitted and therefore divinely authorized to interpret and explain the implications of the Holy Quran. In our previous video on sects of Islam, we talked about how you know, Shiites say that you have to have a living imam to have the interpretation. Well, Sunnis here are saying, no, you have the hadiths, which are the collections of Muhammad. You need Muhammad himself to do the interpreting. And they say they have that in their hadiths. Okay? As a matter of fact, in one hadith, I kind of thought they got carried away, where he said that Muhammad himself knew about these hadiths that were written down. Bukhari 198, page 79, says, I, meaning Muhammad, have thought that none of you will ask me about it before you, Abu Huraira, as I know you're longing for the learning of hadiths. You know, I mean, how did he prophesy about something that wasn't collected yet? But anyway, speaking of Abu Huraira, many of the hadiths, especially in Bukhari, are Abu Huraira is given as a source. And this is significant because it says, narrated Abu Huraira, I said, O Allah's apostle, I hear many narrations from you, but I forget them. He, meaning Muhammad, said, spread your covering sheet. I spread my sheet, and he moved both his hands as if scooping something, you know, like in the air, and emptied them in the sheet and said, wrap it. I wrapped it around my body, and since then, I have never forgotten a single hadith. This is from Bukhari, volume 5, number 841, page 538.
Bukhari 4.
Bukhari 4, number 841, page 538. And also volume 5, number 452, page 332.
You mean volume 9?
Volume 9. I'm sorry. Okay, 452. All right, so if there was Abu Huraira never forgot anything as one yet another miracle of the Prophet, and he said all these things, then that would give high credibility to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other hand is like, being a non-Muslim, do I think these hadiths are substantially accurate or not? And let me give you kind of the cons, and then let me give you the pros. Well, I think many of them are. Well, first of all, against them, they were collected over 200 years after Muhammad's death. So a lot of stuff could get put in or changed or something like that. On the other side of the coin, though, there were different collections, you know, six early ones that were cross-referenced on each other, and they were independent. I mean, Tirmidhi was a pupil of Bukhari, but other than that, they were pretty independent. But in addition to that, there are four early biographers of Muhammad, and they wrote biographies of his life earlier than the collections of hadiths. And one was Al-Waqidi, or Wahidi, who died 823 A.D., Ibn Sa'd, who died 845 A.D., Ibn Ishaq, and Ibn Jar al-Tabari, who died in 923 A.D. He was a little after some of the hadiths. Okay, so these kind of serve as a cross-check on the hadiths, too. So with that, you know, Sunni Muslims also admit, and looking in the footnotes, that, you know, some of these hadiths may have been an error, some numbers might be wrong. So they agree that there were small, insignificant errors in the hadiths. And so accepting that, I could say that it seems like with all the cross-references, you know, many of the hadiths might be fairly accurate. And the issue is not where things, you know, made up wholesale by these collectors, Bukhari and Sahih and Muslim and people like that, but could things have slipped in? And there's no way to really, you know, check that. You know, they certainly could have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the Sunnis themselves have different sects and different schools. One of the earliest ones were the...
One thing I'd like to mention before you go to that is you mentioned before about abrogated hadiths.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that play into all of this?
All right. Well, there are certain hadiths, like, for example, there's hadiths that permit temporary marriage. Just, you know, you can marry a woman for a week or a day or whatever. But then there are other hadiths that indicate that was abrogated.
Okay, so how do you know which hadiths are... I guess that's where al-Bukhari comes in and these other guys. They had to make a decision what's abrogated and what's not.
In a few cases, they put the hadith and then there was a note saying, you know, it was abrogated.
Okay.
But in some cases, there, you know, there's nothing that says it's abrogated. And conservative Muslims say, well, it's not abrogated.
Okay. But other people might say it is.
If they read them, yeah.
Okay.
They may never have read them, actually.
Okay.
I've met a number of Muslims that is like, well, they, you know, don't necessarily know too much about them themselves. that's okay. But
okay.
All right. So anyway, there were some early Sunni schools, like the Mutazilites, were founded by Wasl bin Atta, and they were a very early school. You might think of them as almost like rationalists. They said that reason was the most important, and they reacted against this tendency to say that these attributes of God, the 99 names of God, they're not independent entities, they aren't parts of God. God doesn't have 99 parts, they're just descriptions, is what they said. And anything that made Allah appear to have, you know, hands or anything else, they said they wanted nothing to do with saying Allah had like a physical image or body or was anything really like a man. Kind of like very distinct and almost mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
The Mutazilites, unlike most Sunnis, they said the Quran was created, and they emphasized human responsibility as opposed to like a kind of a predestined, impersonal, you know, fatalism. They were also somewhat skeptical of Hadith, but remember, this is before they had the collections, and Sunni Muslims today would say, well, they had good right to be back then. All right, but about 849 AD, they kind of ran out of favor. Okay, Ash'ari was he started a school. He was a former Mutazilite, but he was kind of the forerunner of some of the other schools, and he kind of wanted to make sure that a lot of logic was behind the Sunni schools. Then you had another one called the Zahiriya, which is another name for it as the Dawoodiya, was started by Dawood Stuk. They rejected human reasoning, but they accepted analogies. So at the beginning, I told you, you know, about the logic and you know, analogies
and stuff.
So they're kind of like sorting this out right here. Then you had the Qadarites, who said, man has power over his own actions. They were also against kind of predestination. And one early leader, Mabad al-Jahani, he was executed for his teaching by Muslims in 699 AD. Then you had the Mirjites, postponers. Now this is sort of interesting. They're sort of political, compromisers. They were very big on you should never judge anybody. So even as bad as the Abbasids and Umayyads and other Muslim rulers might be, and as much as they flouted the Quran, one ruler, for example, died in a pool of wine, which obviously is pretty much against the Quran. These guys said you never judge anybody because you never know a person's actions till the day of judgment, and so anything goes.
Those guys sound a lot like some of these people that are in the Christian faith that they get mad any time you judge anything.
Yeah.
And even the drunkards know that one Bible verse, judge not lest you also be judged.
Yeah.
You know? There are, you know, the drunkards and the dope users and the people that are into all kinds of evil things, they may not know much about the Bible, but they know that one verse.
Yeah.
And they get upset whenever
they
get judged.
So it's one thing to actually try to want to understand that verse, and another thing to just try to, you know, have your favorite excuse. And the truth of that is that Paul actually says that we are supposed to judge among ourselves, but we are to judge actions.
Oh, yeah. In fact, right in that same passage, Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, where that comes from, judge not, he tells you a few verses down to judge.
Mm-hmm.
He says, don't cast the pearls of the gospel, this is Jesus Christ talking, before the swine of unbelief.
Swine or pigs.
So you have to make a judgment whether you're dealing with swine or someone that's willing to listen, or in other passages talks about these guys are brute beasts or dogs.
Right.
You have to make judgments.
Yeah.
Right, about things. So you are to judge. I just couldn't help but think of all these people out there, particularly some people that may be watching our show, which we do and love for our, mm-hmm. our Muslim friends and neighbors, and for other people who may be in contact with them. We don't do these shows out of hatred, but there's always someone out there that says, you shouldn't be judging the Muslims or anybody else. But we ourselves are not doing any kind of judgment in the sense of just out of our own opinions. We like to judge things by the Word of God because we're told
right.
to by the Bible, the Holy Scriptures. Even the Quran says to go with the Bible.
Yeah, and
the Bible says to judge.
And if they really think you should not judge in any way at all, it's like, so do they think we're wrong in saying this? Well, then they're judging
us. They're judging us. It's a hypocritical stand. And then if you're a parent, you can't even judge your own kids. Johnny! you can't do that. And the little kid says, sure I can. You can't judge me.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. Criminals or whatever. Yeah, we go on. But anyway, today there are four main Sunni schools. There's the Hanafi school, spelled different ways. It was started by Abu Hanifa, who died 767 A.D., and it was kind of some uncertainty. Was it really started by him, or was it really started by his two disciples? But anyway, it kind of goes back to that time. Disciples were Abu Yusuf and Muhammad al-Shabani. And the Abbasids and the Ottomans generally followed this school. And the majority of Sunnis who know about the different schools and subscribe to one of the four schools, this is the most popular school. Another one was the Shafi'is, started by al-Shafi, who died 820 A.D., and he stressed four bases of authority: the Quran, the Hadith, analogy, and the consensus of all Muslims. The last one he stressed because Muhammad allegedly said, my people will never agree on an error. So if all Muslims agree something is right or wrong or black or white, then it must be that way.
Yeah, if everybody says it's true, it must be true. Yeah. That's basically what he's saying.
Yeah, now these four ways of finding out something were originally distinctive of the Shafi'ite school, but actually they've kind of been accepted by all the schools. Okay. Now the Hanbalites are the smallest school, started by Ahmad bin Hanbal, who died in 885 A.D., and they are usually the most liberal ones. And the Malachite...
Literal, sorry.
Right. The Malachite school was started by Malik bin Anna, who died in 975 A.D. Now, one quick thing, if you notice all these dates of when the school started, they all started about, roughly the same time, maybe 200-300 years after Muhammad, and, things haven't changed much since then. And so to be a strict Sunni, conservative Sunni, you would say, well, basically, that's kind of the end of the story as far as, teaching goes, and that's the way the world should be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Moving on, we really can't ignore the political aspects of Islam. Islam is a way of life that basically says how to run a government, how to do everything. It's very different from Christianity, which says that, well, this is something for the individual, and while there are general things you can say about government, it doesn't regulate everything like Islam attempts to do. The first caliph was Abu Bakr. And he was caliph from Muhammad's death, in 632.
Now, caliph is what for the viewers?
He is a combination of like a pope in Catholicism and a military ruler.
So he kind of controls everything, the religious aspects and the governmental, physical aspects of the populations that he's
right.
leader of.
Right. And he says who lives and who dies. If someone's treason against the caliph, then they can be executed for that reason alone.
So in a way, Muhammad was sort of like that.
Yeah. And now, it's kind of interesting. Muhammad himself, he was given a poison, a mutton, sheep, about a year before he died. Now, he died, he recovered from that, but did that contribute to his, natural death or not? We don't know. Abu Bakr died a peaceful death also. He's about the only caliph we're going to discuss who did die a peaceful death.
Yeah.
All right. From 632 to 634 A.D., when he died peacefully, he spent most of his time punishing defectors. After Muhammad died, a lot of people said, we don't want to be Muslims anymore, and Muhammad can't lead the army, so we're not going to be. And
so they want to go back to their cultural religions and things that they had before Muhammad came.
Right. And modern Muslims today say, Muslim is a religion of freedom of conscience. Well, Abu Bakr apparently never got the message. And maybe modern Muslims know more about Islam than Abu Bakr, or maybe not.
Now, where are you getting your information on this? Are you making this up, or did you find this in the
Hadith? Not making anything up. This is a combination of the Hadith. There's also a lot of good material in this huge set of encyclopedias called Encyclopedia of Islam. Sort of like maybe almost the same size as Encyclopedia Britannica, maybe not quite as big, but and also
it's all documented right there.
Right.
So he's actually persecuting anybody that tries to leave Islam
right. At
that time.
Right.
This Abu Bakr.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Now after him was another companion of the Prophet, Umar bin Khattab, and he was born 581 A.D. and he was assassinated by a Persian slave with a poisoned dagger. Now, he was assassinated in 644 A.D., and they conquered Persia in 637 A.D., so it's like, we don't know what happened there. But anyway, he conquered Syria, and he was kind of involved in the first and second phases of the Muslim expansion.
Okay.
All right, Uthman bin Affan was caliph after Umar's assassination until his own assassination in 656 AD, and a rebel Muslim force attacked Medina, and he was assassinated, you know, by a Muslim at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now there was revolt against him in 655 AD in Kufa, and Kufa would be a source of trouble for the Caliphs from that time on. Now, Uthman, also pronounced Uthman or Usman, was known for standardizing the Quran. He ordered all copies of the Quran to be turned into him, and he would burn them, and he would reissue new copies. And a few copies didn't get turned in and survived, and that's how we know the changes and that were done.
In fact, we've done a previous video on this, and
right.
There's even on record in, I think, the museum in Egypt, in Cairo.
Al-Azhar Museum, yes.
Yeah, where they show some of these other copies that Uthman wasn't able to get his hands on to burn them.
Right.
So there were other Qurans out there, but Uthman didn't want that because they contradicted his version of the Quran.
Right, like the first surah is missing. What you want to say.
So basically, he's trying to come up with one Quran because there's all these different Qurans and they're saying different things and contradictory things. And, of course, that kind of hurts your religious zeal when you don't have a uniform, standardized version. So Uthman tried to...
Yeah, if it's the words and, you know, everything that's important rather than the meaning. The other thing is, prior to him, Umar, when Egypt was conquered, there was this huge library of hundreds of thousands of copies of priceless ancient books and Bibles and everything else in Alexandria, Egypt. And the Muslims burned the whole thing. And supposedly it took them months and months to burn all those books. And the reason they burned them is they said, well, if what is in there contradicts the Quran, then it's false and burn it. And if what is in there is also in the Quran, then we don't need it. So they burned everything.
So the old, let's get rid of the evidence.
Right, right.
One way or the other.
And it's like, so when Muslims come back and say, well, you know, if you don't you have more early Bible manuscripts? Well, we probably would have had more if Umar hadn't burned them.
That's right, that's right.
Okay. Well, and anyway, moving on, after Uthman was assassinated, Ali bin Abu Talib, who, as we said before, Shiites thought ought to have been the caliph in the first place, he became caliph in 656 A.D., and he was assassinated by Muslims again in 661 A.D. Okay, when he became caliph, there was a revolt at the Battle of the Camel where he killed two generals, and he captured Aisha, who was with the rebels. Now, Aisha was maybe one of the most beloved wife of Muhammad, or maybe the second most beloved wife. You know, we can, you know, argue about that. But
so Muhammad's wife Aisha was against, with these rebels against the
right,
caliph.
Right. He didn't kill her, but he captured her. So it was so much for, and Kufa was Ali's capital.
Now, what's interesting there? I mean, here you've got the actual wife of the prophet, and she's with the revolters.
Right.
So there must have been some kind of religious division there, or some kind of disagreement that was going on. If they're actually in a battle, in a war, and there had to be a disagreement.
Right. And Ali, by the way, was the son-in-law of the prophet through Fatima, who was the daughter of Muhammad's first wife, who died before he was there.
Well, as we're going through these caliphs, it looks like they're all ending up in bloody deaths, except for the first one.
Yeah. It's like, caliph isn't something you really want to be, I suppose. Now, the next one was one of the rebels who was successful. All right, Muawiyah the first, actually, he was Uthman's cousin. And after Ali became caliph, he criticized Ali to say he didn't do enough to capture Uthman's murderers. And so he had Uthman's bloody shirt as almost like a flag, and he led a revolt against Ali. And Ali sent his army to crush him, and they had a big battle at Siffin, which is near the Euphrates River. Now, Kufa is actually in Iraq, and the others were in like Damascus, Syria. And at Euphrates River, Ali's forces were winning. And then Muawiyah's fighters, they put pages of the Quran on the end of their spears. And they said that are you going to fight and attack this holy book? And so Ali's fighters, who were, you know, sincere, all stopped. And they said, well, we got to do something here, so why don't we have an arbitration? And so Ali had one person representing him as a judge, and Muawiyah I had one as a judge, and they decided to figure out, well, who's going to be the rightful caliph? And the arbitrator Amir for Muawiyah, he persuaded the other arbitrator that in the interest of peace, neither one should be caliph. So they deposed both of them as caliph. Then after they're both deposed, then Amir went and he made Muawiyah caliph again. So Ali, basically, who was winning the battle, got conned out of being caliph. Okay. And anyway, so soon after that, Ali was stabbed with a poison weapon on January 24th, 661 AD, which is a very important holiday, kind of a holiday in a sad way, for Shiites. And Sunnis even recognize that something very wrong happened here.
So this guy didn't last too long after he's made caliph, he's murdered by a poison weapon.
Right. And anyway, after Fatima died, his wife, Muhammad's daughter, Ali had 8 wives and 33 children. And this is important because these people would be possible potential heirs, in the Shiite world of Ali.
Right, right.
Okay. Then after Muawiyah won was Yazid the First, who was generally acknowledged to be corrupt. And then a guy named Abdullah claimed to be caliph in 683 A.D., but then Abd al-Malik, the real caliph, put down Abdullah's revolt, and the way he did it was that he sacked Mecca. So he captured and killed many people in Mecca. A fire broke out in the Kaaba, and even the sacred meteorite was cracked. And another thing is made Arabic the official language. So things got pretty bloody. Even if you were in Mecca and a Muslim, you weren't safe.
It just seems just one battle and fight over control after another, political assassinations, it's a real mess.
Right. And so anyway, after this, these were called the Umayyads, and eventually the Abbasids took over about 747 to 750 AD under Abu al-Abbas. That's why they're called the Abbasids. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he was nicknamed al-Safa. Al-Safa means the blood spiller. Okay. Peaceful name.
Doesn't sound like it's getting any better.
No.
As we go through this history.
In fact, every single Umayyad descendant was beheaded, except for one who escaped named Abd al-Rahman, who escaped to Spain, Moorish Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, one thing about the Sunnis are very clear that Ali had no special treatment, and Shiites, they would almost say that Ali was, sound like he had superhuman strength. He could rip apart a city gate and carry it out single-handedly, when they were besieging the city and things like
this
that.
This is Shiite tradition.
This is Shiite. But now the Sunnis in Bukhari Hadith 950, it says, narrated Abu Juhayfa, I asked Ali, do you have anything divine literature besides what's in the Quran? Or, as Uyana once said, apart from what the people have. Ali said, by him who made the grain split, meaning germinate, and created the soul, we have nothing except what is in the Quran and the ability of understanding Allah's book, which he may endow man with, and what is written on a sheet of paper. And he says, what's a sheet of paper? And he says, well, it's about blood money and the ransom for captives, and no Muslims should be killed as punishment for killing a disbeliever. Okay, and also clearly says Ali was not Muhammad's successor, according to Bukhari 7, verse 5, 736, page 525. Okay, now, so you can see there's the Sunnis have from their next highest source that Ali of the Shiites was, not the right Ali.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. All right, so anyway, not all Sunnis practice all the Hadiths, because the Hadiths actually are pretty strict. For example, it's very clear that veils are required for all Muslim women. Okay. In fact, there is an example, which we may get into in Islam and women, to where there was a woman who ran out of her house like right away without her veil on because there was actually a snake in the house. And right at that time, her husband was coming home, I think, from battle, and he had a spear, and he saw her outside the house, and so his thing was, well, she's out, doesn't have a veil, he's just gonna spear her to death.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, wait, before you do that, go inside and see why he came out. And they saw the snake, and then he understood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that shows clearly, that's only one example, that shows that veils were mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a case to where one of Muhammad's wives was on a camel with someone in her immediate family, which is okay to not wear a veil, and so she took off the veil part, and she was kicked and said, why are you doing that? And she says, well, there's no one around. I says, well, there could be someone around, so, keep it on.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but the veils were required for all women.
No, not quite. All free women.
Free women.
Yeah. They,
this is all according to the Hadith.
Yes. When they captured Khaybar, Muhammad was obviously interested in Safiya, and the Muslims asked, well, is she going to be his wife or not, just to like a slave? And they said, well, see if he has her be veiled or not. And if she's not veiled, then she'll just be a slave. Well, Muhammad did have her veiled, and Safiya became one of the wives of Muhammad.
Okay. That's in the Hadith.
Right. And the slave woman part, well, it's in Bukhari, too, but I know it's in Sahih Muslim, volume 2, 3325 and 3328, page 721 and 722. All right. Also, of course, Muslims are forbidden to worship idols or drink wine or eat pork, but Muslims are forbidden to sell wine or idols of pork. This is according to Sahih Muslim, volume 3, page 828 to 830. And so Sunni Muslims, if they work in a convenience store and they're selling alcohol, and I know there are probably pornographic magazines there.
I can think of a lot of convenience stores I've been in, 7-Elevens and Wagabags and these other little convenience stores that were employed by Muslims. Muslims were working there.
And I mean, they always have sausage or pork or
exactly.
stuff there too.
And they're violating the Hadith when they
when
they're working in these places selling this.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone has the right to make a living, and we actually have no objection, to Muslims working there or working anywhere else. I mean, I've worked personally with a number of Muslims, and that's fine, but just kind of notice that, they can't claim they're really following the Hadith if they work in a place like that.
Right.
But
they're violating the Islamic tradition.
Right. Another thing, Muhammad, I know you're an avid fan of chess, but Muhammad knew of chess, and Muslims are not supposed to play chess, at least Sunni Muslims. And this is according to Sahih Muslim, Volume 4, page 1222.
And I mentioned in our other video series on this that at work there was a Muslim guy. He even wore the Muslim outfit. He always had his Quran, and he loved to play chess with us all the time,
Yeah.
And so there's another perfect example.
Now, if he wasn't a Sunni, he's off the hook. But if he really wants to be Sunni and really is consistent about following Hadith, then he's not supposed to do that.
Yep. No chess playing Sunnis.
Yep. Now, the other thing to think about is, okay, so Sunnis, conservative Sunnis at least, they really stress the traditions. But what that means is that the Quran itself is not sufficient. Okay? It requires the interpretation of the Hadith, or you won't know the true meaning. Okay, actually, though, Sunnis, they do reject much tradition. For example, the Shiites have a collection of Hadiths, too, and the Sunnis don't necessarily accept that. They accept their own. Now, of course, the Sunnis can say that the Shiite Hadiths were given much later, which is true, and so that's why they want to do the earlier ones. And that kind of makes sense. But then why do you reject the still earlier traditions that agree with the Bible? From 97 A.D., from the letter of Clement to Rome on, there have been a lot of Christian traditions and Christian writings apart from the Bible that validate and show that what the Bible taught, it has been a consistent message from them to now.
Right.
And why not say those traditions too? In fact, for that matter, if you believe that God's preserved His Word, then how can you believe that He totally grossly corrupted His Word with the Bible? Okay, we have Bible manuscripts preserved from 100 A.D., 125 to 175 A.D., and a fragment, John Rylands, from around 127 A.D. And many Muslims may not be aware of this, but it's like, now that you are aware, it's like, well, why not say that, well, maybe Allah did preserve His Word, because we have copies of it from way back that early. And I trust God that He did preserve everything. Now, the thing that should be said, though, is that when Muslims, they would typically have an answer for that, and the answer doesn't have a thing to do with archaeology or history, but they would say, well, one answer is there's a lot of manuscript variations. And that is true. We have about 97.3% certain of every single word in the New Testament, but that's about 2.7% uncertainty. But the thing about it, though, is we have those variations, so we have everything in the New Testament. It's just, in some cases, we aren't sure if it's this word or this other word.
And also, in that small percentage that doesn't fit in that 97% you just mentioned, there's not one key thing that affects any essential or vital Bible doctrine.
That's right.
The Bible doctrine stays the same throughout all those variations, as a Muslim apologist would argue. So they can't get out of the fact that all these Bible texts say that Jesus is God. They say that Jesus died on the cross. They say that He made a blood sacrifice for our sins. And all these other doctrines, these are not changed. And so just to say, well, there's some variations, does not change the fact that 97% of these things match up in the manuscript evidence.
Right. Examples of variations are like, how do you spell Judas Iscariot? Well, there are many variations. At the end of Philippians and Revelation, should you have the word amen or not? All right. Now, so most of these variations are phrasing, spelling, things like that. The two most significant variations, I should, you know, be honest and tell you, are the ending of the Gospel of Mark and what's called the pericope of the adulteress in the Gospel of John 7, I think 56 to 8:11.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's compare this with Islam. Well, Islam, the Quran has a lost surah according to Sahih Muslim, Volume 2, number 2286, which is page 500 and 501. Okay, Bukhari, volume 6509, says that when certain people died, parts of the Quran known only to them were lost. Okay, and there are other Bukhari hadiths you can see on the screen that talk about missing parts of the Quran or abrogated parts of the Quran too. Okay, also there are various versions of the Quran. We are talking about Uthman. And some of the variations, for example, is that you have a couple of surahs that were not in some Quran manuscripts that are there today. The first one, and I believe it's the last surah. Okay, and so with that, yes, you know, there are small differences in the Bible as well as the Quran. The problem with many Muslims believe the Quran has to be word for word identical. You know, has it word for word the same. Maybe not all Muslims, but many. They have a real problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if Christians were to say, you know, the Bible has to be word for word identical, they'd have a problem too, but we don't. You know, most Christians say that it's the meaning that counts.
Right.
Okay, so we don't subscribe to what's called mechanical dictation theory.
Exactly.
And we believe that the inerrant word of God has been preserved infallibly, which means without significant error, but some minor transmission errors did creep in, but it doesn't affect the truth.
Now, what you just said there is also significant because in our other video series that we've done on Muslim apologists, we even point out and play a clip of a Muslim apologist using that very argument that the Bible... And he says the Bible contradicts itself. It's not word for word,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you can't trust it and all this kind of stuff. But then we even show from the Quranic text that it lists different surahs in the Quran that are saying the same thing but in a slightly different way, which falls in line more with the way the Bible presents a lot of information. Yet the Muslims ignore their own Quran.
Kind of like different gospel accounts.
Exactly. And the Quran does the same thing.
They
assume that the Westerner wouldn't know about that anyway, so they can go ahead and make their argument and hope that, you know, slide the rest under the rug.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead, brother.
Well, so the bottom line is, if the textual manuscript issues are less significant in the Bible than the Quran, because we don't have, you know, lost surahs or anything else, we have this wealth of evidence, we haven't burned it all, and you want to follow traditions, then if you're going to follow tradition, follow the early and most reliable traditions. Follow and trust God that He can preserve His Word, as He promised to do in the Bible. And as the Quran, which I believe is not from God, it even says that God could preserve His Word. And so if God can preserve His Word, then believe it.
Right. So what we have here is we've gone through this particular show. We've looked at all these caliphs. We've seen the kind of the violent nature of Islam. We already talked about the jihads, the percentage of the hadiths, which really cover the jihad, the war, the collecting of the booty, and then the other things they consider like funerals and ritual washings and things of that nature, which seem to be so important in the Islamic life. But as we got about 4 minutes left in this program, talk a little bit more about the differences in what the Quran would say on any subject you'd like, really, and what the Bible would say. Let's take war, for instance. A lot of people are interested in this Islamic concept of jihad.
Mm-hmm.
In a Muslim apologist and people that come from a Muslim perspective, they always dismiss that jihadic reference from the Quran and the Hadith by saying, well, Christianity is just bad because of the Crusades and mm-hmm. all this type of stuff. What does the Bible really say about this subject? And are we to spread Christianity with the sword and take captive women? And even if they're married, you know, we can make them our wives. All right.
Well, the Bible has the highest standards, you know, of purity that, you know, Jesus taught. And that in the New Testament, we are supposed to love even our enemies. Okay, and we're not to take revenge on people. Jesus never said fight anybody or kill anybody. The Crusades were a very un-Christian thing by people who just call themselves Christians. Now,
these Crusaders violated almost everything the Bible taught.
Right. Now, I will say in Romans 12, it does say that the state does not bear the sword for nothing. So at a state level, there's a right to, like, you know, punish criminals and to fight wars, at least for defensive purposes. But at an individual level, we're not to do that.
Right. Jesus said, turn the other cheek.
Right.
And interpersonal relationships and things of that nature. So there's a vast difference between what the Bible teaches, not only on that issue, but like, for instance, the Quran says Jesus was not crucified. The Bible says Jesus was crucified. We go back to the manuscript evidence, the historical evidence, the early church writings, which predate Muhammad. There's no doubt about it.
Muhammad even read the Gospels, according to Aisha.
Exactly. According to the Hadiths. Muhammad was aware of these Gospels and things like that.
Right.
And that evidence was there before Muhammad came along.
Mm.
So he just point blank denied the crucifixion of Christ in the Quran. Even though the evidence, the historical evidence, shows that Jesus was crucified, and it doesn't have to be just from the Bible records, the gospel records. It can be from Gnostic accounts. It can be from pagan accounts.
He threw a lot of things in there.
Jewish accounts, like Justin Martyr. I think of Tacitus, the Roman.
Justin Martyr was Christian, but go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, what did I say? Did I say Justin Martyr?
Yeah.
I meant Josephus.
Okay.
I'm glad you corrected me on that. Now, I'm talking about Josephus, the Jewish historian that was with Titus at the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Mm. And we go on all these things. But as our time runs out, brother, I'm going to just mention to our viewers that if they'd like some free literature, get on our mailing list for our newsletters. We have newsletters such as our Christian Answers newsletters on different topics. This one here happens to be on the testimony of the eternal Godhead, the Trinity, which also is denied in the Quran. And when it comes to matters of who's telling the truth, the only way you're really going to find the truth is to study and analyze. Don't just take our word for it or someone else's word for it. You have to go and do the research. You have to do the study yourself and find out who's really giving you, you know, the truth about the situation. That's what all religions claim, is they claim the truth. But they can't all be right because they're all saying different things.
Right.
But anyway,
either killing Christians is right or wrong.
We have our newsletter. You get a free subscription to that. We have tracks. Here's some of Steve's on the Bukhari Hadith of Islam. These are free for the asking caller number at the end of the show. Check our website, Muslim Hope.
.com.
Website, MuslimHope.com. We also have Bible Query.
.org.
If you'd like to check out our website information, write us or call us. The numbers are at the end of the screen. I'm Larry Wessels with Christian Answers. I'm here with our Director of Research, Steve Morrison. Great to always have you here, brother.
Okay.
Join us again next time in this continuing series on Islam. Thank you very much. God bless.